Bucket Problem, episode 13. I am your host, Ace Anbender. We are brought to you, as always, by Home Field Apparel. I will get it out of the way right now. Use promo code BUCKETPROBLEM for 15% off your first order at homefieldapparel.com. Michigan is coming off a 31-10 just pasting of Washington that really was not as close as the final score would indicate, mostly because Michigan runs for 343 yards at 6 yards a clip. They put the passing game away for the most part, which we'll get to the discussion and the discourse about that. But Michigan did not need to do anything but run the ball at Washington. They did it at will, and they come away with a very comfortable three-score win over a Pac-12 team that is, yes, 0-2, and yes, lost to an FCS team in Montana, but is coached by a pretty good defensive coach and does maybe have a pretty good defense. We'll find out over the course of the rest of the season. That offense is abject, so we can only take away so much from Michigan completely shutting them down. But, I mean, other than the offensive play calling stuff, which again we'll get to later, it was hard to have anything but like complete good vibes coming out of this game. We are going to do what we did last week and start off the podcast with our big moods. I want to start off with Alex's, because he was the one of us who was at the game and actually like got to take in the entire night game atmosphere. So, Alex, thanks for being on again. How was it actually being there?
It was great. We tailgated at Pioneer High School. Go Pioneers. So I thought of you while I was there, Ace.
Purple but, Pride, baby.
Yeah, I really enjoyed being at the game. My big mood of the week was not necessarily the whole game atmosphere, but a specific moment where Phil Brabs was honored for his contribution to the 2002 victory over Washington, which was the last time the Huskies had traveled to Ann Arbor. That was actually a game I attended as a small child. And for those who don't remember it, Michigan missed 3 field goals, including a chip shot with only a couple minutes left, and eventually got in place for a 4th field goal attempt, kind of long. I don't think there was anybody in that building who thought that kick was going to go in.
Nope.
Phil Brabs split the uprights, and my family's season tickets were actually in the north end zone about 10 rows up. So that was coming right at us. And yeah, one of the iconic moments, I guess, of Michigan football in my childhood. It was a top 15 matchup. I remember seeing Lee Corso put on the Husky head on the field right before the game when they had the set in the stadiums back then. And yeah, seeing him honored, and he wound up not really doing much over the course of his college career besides that kick. But I don't know if you've followed him on social media, you'll know that he has actually battled cancer at a tragically young age and overcome it. It was like in the 2nd or 3rd quarter, they showed him on the Jumbotron and he got a nice standing ovation. And yeah, to think about how much has changed over the course of those 20 years, both for him, for the program, for even the stadium. We didn't have night games back then, and the luxury boxes weren't there, no Jumbotrons in the end zone, so on and so forth. It was really cool to see him honored, and it was just good vibes all night long. Another player, former player who was honored was Steve Hutchinson, and I'm pretty sure everybody in the Big House thought that was Aiden's dad. Not
the case. He was also there.
Yeah.
They showed him on TV a lot.
Hand up, absolutely was in that group until yesterday when people started tweeting about it. I had no, I thought there was only one Hutchinson. I'm so sorry.
You're supposed to be our offensive line guy, dude.
It's funny because I was like, I did have the thought before that I was like, oh, that's crazy that he's like an all-pro offensive guard and a doctor. Like, that's
Dan.
I had that thought. And I was like, I'm like, yeah, he's just a talented guy, I guess. You know, good for him. And it's like, embarrassing of me in retrospect.
Before Alex continues, Chris Hutchinson was a very good defensive end for Michigan in the late 80s. A very, very good defensive end. And maybe early 90s. I hope I have my years right. Anyway, Alex, continue.
Yeah, I guess Steve Hutchinson tweeted, something along the lines of, like, he was quote tweeting Aiden Hutchinson, who's like, by the way, Steve's not my dad, which apparently he felt compelled to give that fact check. But
I wonder why.
Steve was like, man, if I was Chris's little brother, I would have gotten so much more love on campus when I was there, which I thought was funny. But yeah, I actually sat, my seats for the game were a couple rows behind the block of Washington fans in the southwest end zone. So I saw their reactions all game. You know, they were super excited when their team took the field. They brought part of the band with them that were crammed into the upper deck seats. But once they transitioned from Steve Hutchinson's Wolverine highlights to his highlights in the pros as a Seahawk, and again, he was one of the probably the best offensive linemen of his generation, he got a good cheer from the Washington fans, and that was one of the only times they cheered all game because it was a complete ass kicking. And from a visiting fan's perspective, I would put that atmosphere up with what I saw back in 2019 in Happy Valley for a whiteout, because it might not have been as loud as that, but just the color really came through with the crowd. And yeah, the game momentum was against Washington all game. So yeah, it was a great environment and a great win.
Yeah, that the atmosphere certainly popped on watching it on TV, and it certainly sounded like it was quite loud in there. I've been to a couple Penn State whiteout night games at this point. We won't discuss them any further. That was pretty close to that level in terms of how it came off on
TV.
Yeah,
I've been to plenty of games at the Big House over the years, and that was about as good of an environment as I can remember in terms of noise.
And it was also by far the most coordinated the fans have ever been in terms of wearing the same color. It's not even close. It was good that they had that in mid-September and got nice weather for it.
Yeah, I was going to say that was definitely, I mean, I always kind of like, I think the whole like, oh, the Big House is overrated is an overrated take because, you know, I think we've talked about this before, but the reason the Big House is quieter than it should be is because it's, you know, convex, like, right? It's like so much sound escapes up into the air. It's because it was built like 1,000 years ago. But when they didn't have like, you know, sharp angles. Anyway, the point being, like, I thought it was interesting that I thought it was, you know, I was pleasantly surprised that, you know, we got all the entire crowd to do the same thing, and you know, it was a pretty raucous environment, and you know, it's, I think it really came across the recruits that were there too. So yeah, it was pretty good to just see those like vibes and feel like there was real momentum behind the program again.
Yeah, and I don't want to wade into this discourse at all, but the crowd belted out Mr. Brightside. They were really singing it from the bottom of their lungs.
Let's go ahead and wade into this. Mr. Brightside is fine. It makes me feel very, very old, but it's fine.
It's
cool
a good
that
song
we have
off
a
of
thing.
A good album. Yeah, I agree.
People want, okay, here's my take, right? People want like a more intimidating song. And I get that, okay? I get that it's a song about like getting cucked,
being down real bad,
right?
Down the baddest.
Yeah, and I totally understand that, but you need a singable karaoke song to
exactly.
be for that many people to sing in unison. You know, like
yeah.
you can't. I mean, look, it would be sick to do like X-Gone Give It to You. Like I would like that would be like very intimidating. But like,
man, if you thought the boomers were mad now,
yeah, right, exactly. My question
I'm
is always like,
go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
No. Yeah, I just think it's like it's the perfect song to have 100,000 people sing along to, and it sounds objectively cool. Like you can't help but get like goosebumps. You know what I mean? So anyway,
it is one of the best white people karaoke songs for people under the age of like 40. So it's a good fit in that regard.
Thanks for including
me,
Alex.
A very serious take here, though, which is that as you guys always make fun of me for. I'm a Duke alumnus. I spent a ton of time in Cameron Indoor. And say what you want about Duke, Cameron is a genuinely tough place to play, famously. And
enough.
It is very loud and very hot, I might add, in there. And do you guys know, I think I told you guys this, you guys remember I told you what the Cameron Crazies, the song that we always sing is?
I'm trying, is it Phil Collins?
No, it's way worse than that.
Oh, I forget what it was, but I knew it was bad.
It's Every Time We Touch by Cascada.
Oh, Lord, that's right.
Which is an incredibly
girly... What do you mean worse? I thought you said worse.
That is a really, like girly dance, not very good dance song. Like, it, there's just so many reasons that it's not intimidating. It has nothing to do with sports. It's like, it's not even a very good song, but it gets everybody rocking jumping up and down. And like, that's what you want. And I think this is a classic case of Michigan fans overthinking things, which we love to do. So
I wonder what Zion Williamson thinks when he looks over and sees a bunch of nerdy kids singing that song.
I do happen to think that that Mr. Brightside, you know, is a good song, but you know, I have bad taste, so that's okay. But it, first of all, like the song everyone goes to, like as like the example, is "Jump Around" at Wisconsin. And I'm sorry, I like the song "Jump Around." It is not a good song, like to listen to, like just as you know, like as like you know. If you were just like picking a song to like play at like a party or something that wasn't in the context of like, you know, thousands of people jumping around to it. So
I do think Hot Fuss is a really good album. So like,
I agree.
Yeah. Like I think it's a good song. Do I regret wading into that discussion? Possibly. But here we are. My big mood, is meat, which is my praise for the offensive line, because for Michigan to come out in a game against a team that has a pretty large defensive front, is pretty stout up front. Now, that wasn't, you know, the strength for Washington for a long time has been their secondary, but you would have expected Michigan to at least have to, you know, throw a change up every once in a while, and they had 56 run plays and 15 pass plays. That's an astonishing mix, and it worked. And it worked because Washington could never stop Michigan from consistently gaining yards. They only recorded 3 tackles for loss all game, which is, again, pretty astonishing on 56 rushing attempts. And Michigan didn't just do... I mean, for Michigan to have turned over as many starters as they have, be breaking some new guys in... have kind of changed their lineup a little bit for this one, because Zach Zinter went from being rotated in as the sixth lineman in the Western game because he was hurt to starting in this game and playing the majority of it with a big old club on his hand and looking fantastic. I mean, they're rotating through 6 or 7 guys because you got Chuck Filiaga in there too. I mean, they are running both zone and gap concepts and doing stuff that we didn't necessarily see them do last year. There's a Seth Fisher posted a really excellent neck sharpies on MGO blog that kind of details a wrinkle to counter Trey that Michigan put in there. And that's like, it's intricate stuff, and it's stuff that you wouldn't necessarily expect Michigan to be running in week two, and running without seeing any major blown assignments up front. Like we didn't see a scenario where a Michigan running back got lit up in the backfield because, you know, a lineman was pulling the wrong way, or, you know, a guy missed a gap. It was extremely consistent, and then they were moving guys. And that is exactly what you want to see at this point. We might have to do ask again later for pass protection, but I'd feel pretty decent about that with Stuber and Hayes out there as the two tackles. And it seems like the interior of the line, I mean, Vastardis has looked really good, and I would say he was probably the guy I was most worried about on that, in, you know, being at least in terms of like being able to move people around on the offensive line. He's a little bit smaller than they would have, than the guys they would have had out there otherwise. But it's hard to question any of the lineup choices or running calls or even the balance between run and pass plays, at least in that game, when it is working that well. I mean, I detailed in my newsletter that went out yesterday that, I mean, there are like 3 other games since 2000 against, you know, defenses with a pulse where Michigan has had this much success on the ground. And the running backs were obviously a pretty large part of that. Blake Corum looks fantastic. Hassan Haskins looks fantastic. But a ton of those yards were earned by the offensive line. And that's a great sign going forward. And it was really fun to watch on Saturday night. I think that's also important in the context of Sharon Moore taking over as the offensive line coach from Ed Warner. And we obviously had zero idea how that would go because Moore has never coached offensive line before. And at least the early returns on that are pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that real quick. It's good to see because they seem actively better than last year, right? I mean, obviously, you know, it would be hard to be worse than they were last year. But it seems like, I mean, I'm already pretty much ready to say that Sharon Moore is like a good offensive line coach, which is huge. I mean, that was a huge unknown. And coaching offensive line is not something necessarily like, I don't know, coaching running backs, where I think you sort of have it or you don't. You have to do some real work in terms of coaching offensive line. And we knew that Ed Warner was very good at it, and it was a big, big, like, fulcrum point on the season whether or not Sharon Moore would be good at it. And it seems like, I mean, I have rewatched a couple of times, and I just see very few, like, missed assignments, you know. Huge, huge, huge positive for the team's prospects.
Absolutely. And Dan, I'm just going to throw it right back to you because you've got the final big mood that is related specifically to the Michigan game and not another game that we're going to be very pleased to talk about soon.
that game, of course, you know, we're talking about MSU Youngstown State.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think my big mood for this week was kind of a moment of relief that I don't feel like I've had related to Michigan sports since the LSU game, the LSU basketball game back in the Sweet 16, or not even Sweet 16, whatever, the round of 32. Doesn't matter. But in that LSU game, it felt like, you know, Michigan was just always on the brink of pulling away. And it was just a very, very tense game that I was just like biting my nails the entire time. And I think Chauncey Brown at one point hit a three, and I was like, that's the moment. Like we're good. Like, it's going to be okay. And like, I literally, like, you know, I don't really shout too much like when I'm watching the TV because I try to be like a sane person.
I don't believe you.
I'm pretty even keel. I have like my like one moment a game. So that was like my moment. But I had a similar moment in this game. I felt like, you know, it was pretty apparent, like, from the jump that Michigan was the better team. And the question was just going to be, like, whether or not it was going to be the type of game where, you know, Michigan, like, sort of is the better team but lets them hang around and either wins close or maybe even loses. Or is the better team and just, like, pretty comfortably, like, walks away with it. And, you know, Harbaugh goes for that fake punt, which I loved, which we can talk about a little bit later. And then the very next play, Corum just goes through a monstrous gap, pulls away from the safety, and is just 1,000% gone. I stood up and I'm like, you know, you kind of like do your little check for flags. And I was just like, you know, hell yeah. Like I was shouting and being way too loud and probably waking people up. it just felt like a huge, huge relief of just like, this is not going to be like, once that game went to two scores, I'm like, they're not winning this game. Like I can feel pretty good about this. And, it was awesome and it was a great moment. And like, it was cool that, you know, to see just how fast Corum is and to see him put up the Tariq Hill peace sign. That's a Tariq Hill thing, right? That was kind of a thing that he
Tyreek Hill does, yeah. That.
Yes. Okay, sorry. Yeah, you're right. He is problematic. I'm bringing all kinds of problematic energy to the pod. This is the one where we finally get
unlike
canceled.
Unlike normal Dan energy,
unlike normal.
Totally not problematic.
Sorry about that. But the whole thing, it was a huge relief and it felt great, and you know, yeah, great moment.
The angle that the safety took on that run was so bad. Like, you could see it from where I was sitting. It was like, man, he had no idea that this guy was this fast.
He came up like he was tackling prime Davion Smith. And no, that's not what that was, how that was going to go. I can't remember who pointed this out, but somebody mentioned, and at this point, like, my Twitter conversations and reading articles and like group chats and like text messages have all run together into just an absolute mess in my head. So I'm sorry for not crediting whoever mentioned this, but I think that safety was really messed up because he was accustomed to having to come up and charge up very hard at Hassan Haskins because you need to be ready to hit that dude and you need momentum or you're going to get lit up as a safety. And that was an angle that, I mean, it might still not have necessarily been the correct angle for tackling Haskins, but at least would have been a lot closer. But with Corum, it was off by like a solid 10 yards.
Yeah, I think there was, that was pretty much a lose-lose. There was so much space. There was no way that he was going to be able to tackle, honestly, Blake Corum or Hassan Haskins. That was going to be housed regardless.
It was like
literally
perfectly blocked run play by the front there.
It's also like probably better. It's better for that safety that he wasn't close to Corum, because otherwise Corum probably would have just juked or knocked him over, and that would have been more embarrassing than just not being there. So
yeah, he just kind of politely took himself out of the picture.
Yeah, and this is actually worth mentioning. Michigan is number two among Power Five teams with broken tackles right now, and most of those are Haskins and Corum. They're number two only to Alabama in tackles broken. So yeah, you don't, these guys, I mean, I don't know what the arc of Michigan season will be yet, but I do know that every single defense they play, even the best ones, is going to be very sore and miserable about those two running backs at the end of the game. So,
and really quickly before we move on, I would like to point out that the Washington safety responsible for that touchdown was not Alex Cook. And in fact, Alex had a great tackle on Cade McNamara on the one time Michigan kept the ball. So just want to throw that out there in case anybody, you know, has an idea that Alex Cook was responsible for that touchdown, because he definitely wasn't.
When you told us you were going to the game, we had no idea you were going to be in uniform for the other team. And we're going to have to discuss that off air, because I have some thoughts.
Yeah.
Jim saw Alex back there and he was like, yeah, we got to run the ball 52 times today. That kid's sharp. He's got range.
We can't test this guy over the top here.
I've heard him on the podcast. He's a problem.
That's a horrifying thought. For those that are not quite following, there was actually a player named Alex Cook, but maybe not our Alex Cook. Possibly our Alex Cook.
That's my name.
We'll leave that up to y'all. Washington had a defensive back named Alex Cook. Connor, I am so happy to throw it to you for this one, because, I mean, as much as we want to go over Michigan beating Washington, that was a relatively straightforward game, and I feel like we've covered a lot of what we need to cover. And meanwhile, something else happened on Saturday that I think is worth talking about.
Yeah, so Oregon's beef spread destroyed Ohio State's defense. Ran over them, through them, around them. And then Joe Moorhead, their passing game was only okay, honestly, but like Joe Moorhead was able to find the gaps in their coverage when they needed a play. It was actually like clockwork. Like they had a lot of miscues in pass game, actually, but like when they needed to find something, it was always there. And I think I give Moorhead a lot of credit for that. He's a great OC. But more to the point, like Ohio State's defense is bad. Like I'm not even sure that they're mediocre. They look bad, bad. Like, as in not knowing where they're supposed to be, like giving up the edge in pretty remarkable ways at times. Linebackers don't know what gaps they're supposed to be in. They don't seem to have internalized the relatively simple schemes. Their much ballyhooed defensive line, which is where most of their big recruits on defense are, was getting shoved around by Oregon. And Oregon probably has one of the best offensive lines in the country. Although I will say preseason Washington was supposed to be better in the Pac-12, which cracks me up. But Oregon, I mean, respect to Oregon here, but like, you know, I don't think they're a legit national title contender, and they just shoved OSU around, paved them in a not entirely dissimilar way to what Michigan did to Washington. And I mean, I don't need to explain why this is a big mood for Michigan fans. I also don't know how Ohio State will fix it this year, because I think one thing that, you know, demoralized Michigan fans assume about Ohio State is like, oh, well, you know, they must have a bunch of amazing recruits on their bench they can use if their starters aren't good. Not on defense. Jordan Proctor, sadly, was probably one of their best players on defense this year. Their starting safety. Josh Proctor. He's good, and now he's out for the season, it sounds like. And the guys behind him, are like low three stars, like ranked in the 500s and 600s nationally. Actually a lot lower rated than Michigan's backup safeties, not to mention our starting safeties, which is interesting.
Yeah,
I think
one of them they took because it's like Malik Hooker's younger brother. And it was like, yeah. Malik Hooker worked out as a three star, so maybe his brother will. And I mean, we'll see the theory tested.
Yeah, so I think the interesting point here that this is getting into the weeds, but it's like they're all but officially saying that Kerry Coombs is toast. Ohio State's recruiting on the defensive side of the ball has been worse than you think, and two of their biggest recruits on that side of the ball are true freshmen right now. There is some real vulnerability there, and this is not me saying that Michigan's going to beat them, but it is a nice reminder for Michigan fans. We should never assume that they're invincible just because they've been really good. Ohio State fans should not assume that they're invincible just because they've been good, and it's really nice to see them, frankly, suck and suffer.
I love it.
Yeah, their defense just like it just looks like a defense that you would call for like a high school team. Like they just line up in their like cover. It's either cover three or man defense, mostly man, and are in the exact same spots every time. Like they don't even really have like basic like kind of like radar type fronts where everyone lines up in like a blitzing type formation. Like they just line up their linebackers and their defensive linemen and their safeties and cornerbacks in the same place every time. And look, I mean, even if Kerry Coombs is not a good defensive coordinator, he's certainly forgotten more about football than I probably will ever know. But it just like does not seem like a complex defense. And even though it's not complex, it doesn't seem like the players know what their role is in that defense. It seems like they're confused, and that's really like limiting the amount of the amount that they can just take advantage of their athleticism and just play. And it just doesn't really look like something that is going to be turned around within the season. It doesn't seem so much like you're right. I'm not going to get too ahead of myself, but they could certainly figure it out. It wouldn't be the first time that something, you know, breaks their way entirely, but it does feel like something that's going to take like an off season to fix, you know? So I don't know. It's shocking is what I'm saying. It's shocking to see them be that bad, mm-hmm. with that much talent.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if they're going to do a version of what Michigan did last year, which is like a panicked, oh, we got to try to install an entirely new defensive scheme midseason because our normal scheme is getting roasted so badly.
And it'd be calling more cover too, which would be really hilarious. I mean, to Dan's point, like about the simplicity of the defense, that's worked fine for Ohio State in the past, but in the past they've had top 10 picks like at both cornerback positions and like possibly Hall of Fame track edge rusher for longer than we would care to talk about, because they having the Bosa brothers back to back and Chase Young, even when you are recruiting at an absolutely ridiculous level like Ohio State has recruited, that is not always how it turns out, and they are learning that right now with Zach Harrison, who is good, it seems, but not on the Bosa or Young level in terms of his impact as an edge rusher. And when offensive play callers don't have to account for that level of just absolute edge terror, that changes the way you're approaching things on offense. Same with not going up against a true lockdown corner. And now you're starting to see some of the things that came up with Ohio State, even in their best years, where, you know, the linebacker level has been a bit of a concern a lot of the time. And they did keep things really simple on the back end because they've had really good free safeties between Malik Hooker and Jordan Fuller and top-tier cornerback play with Marcus Lattimore and Jeffrey Okuda and, I mean, a whole string of guys. And they might just not have the horses to run that defense this year, and Coombs has never been a schematic genius. I mean, that has not been his calling card. It's been recruiting, to be honest, and then he's kind of been Peter principled into the defensive coordinator spot a couple times, and then eventually bumped back down to secondary coach. And we might be seeing the Peter principle bit this year, especially since, as Connor alluded to, Ryan Day was given the opportunity to voice his support for Coombs in a press conference, and instead of doing that, he just kind of deflected the question and said that they weren't going to make any hard decisions. And That sounds extremely foreboding for both Cougs and Ohio State. Because, as Michigan fans well know, you do not want to be trying to significantly alter your approach mid-season. And you certainly don't want to be doing that while covering up for some possible personnel issues. And it seems like Ohio State might have that at free safety. Their linebacker level, once again, doesn't look that great. And, man, as I keep talking, I'm getting into that dangerous territory that I was warning Dan about. I've had to talk myself down a couple times over the weekend in conversations about, like, oh, boy, like, when we're talking about Ohio State, let's make sure to note that we're talking about, like, moving the needle from, like, what feels like a 20% chance of victory to, like, a 40% chance of victory and not, like, Michigan's got to pave them like they just paved Washington. But I mean, it's hard not to feel some hope.
Yeah, I think it's nice to feel some hope. I do think it's fair, even though I just said, you know, I think that their defense might be a season-long issue, we will see a totally different team and probably, like, even an improved offensive team by the time we play them, you know, in November. So, you know, everything that we just saw this weekend should be taken with a grain of salt. It's mostly just nice to see them, like, you know, be vulnerable. One other thing that I did want to point out that I saw someone post somewhere, I'm sorry that I'm not crediting it correctly, but there was apparently like almost an all-out mutiny on the sidelines in the second half, like of coaches, like Day and Coombs going at each other and players going at Coombs, and Coombs was trying to like install a defense that they had not practiced like since last year, just like on the sideline after halftime. You know, all that taken with a grain of salt, it's coming from like, you know, 24/7 guys that are probably getting the order from Day to make this all about Coombs, which, you know, it might be all about Coombs, but they're definitely getting like the text messages from, you know, whatever GA is about how like, yeah, you know, we're about to make him our sacrificial lamb. But anyway, seems very, very
funny.
They
never do that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll take the bad vibes, right? Like it's, you know, yes. Whenever Michigan does beat, like, someday Michigan will beat Ohio State again, right? I hope. And, like, you know, part of the horrible feeling of them being invincible the last few years has been, like, they just never seem to get into these bad vibes ruts that derail college football teams. Not that we know anything about that as Michigan fans, but I'll take that. I'll take their fans freaking out like a bunch of babies over finally losing a regular season game. And I will say one last thing, which is I do think that their defense will probably get better by the time they face Michigan, just because like the odds favor that happening. But the really wild thing is that you can recruit like them and have zero impact players in your defense. And by zero impact players, I mean, not only do they not have an Aiden Hutchinson or a Dax Hill, they don't even have a Josh Ross. They may not even have like a Mozzie Smith on that team right now, which seems crazy to say.
Put some respect on Haskell Garrett's name.
Okay, fair
yeah,
enough.
Yeah,
fair
the enough. Defensive oh, line on. Is still pretty good.
Oregon blew them off the ball, man. Like, they did not play. I'll say this. They didn't play well. They're still probably better than Michigan's. They did not play well, though.
Oh, yeah. I saw, like, a grand total of 3 snaps. So, yeah, everything with a grain of salt. But coming into the season, the defensive line wasn't supposed to be this bad, right?
I just want to say, Haskell Garrett, if you're listening to this, I do not want to talk badly about you. I will not be slandering a man that was shot in the face and continues to play football. That's not something I'm about to do.
At a very high level. The bucket problem disavows Cotter's take on
yeah, the Mozzie Smith Haskell comment Garrett, was like, the Mozzie Smith take was a hot take.
I know what you're going for.
I'm going to walk that back and just say that, like, just watching, like, examination of film from the last game, I do think Michigan's interior DL deserves a lot of credit for playing quite well, and yes. Ohio State's does not, and this is based on 1 week, but that's all that I really meant there.
To Ace's point that he made earlier about Ohio State no longer having a Bosa or a Chase Young out there, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but that does seem like something that Michigan does have, even if he's not going to be a top 5 draft pick. Aiden Hutchinson was dominant against Washington.
We're going to get to that in a moment, but first, I have another idea for how Michigan can gain an edge in the game. And we figured it out last week, which is we need home field apparel and use the promo code BUCKETPROBLEM for 15% off your first order. To release an Ohio State collection about a month before the game. Give it about a month, because that was about the timing for Washington's big new Saturday drop. And I feel like it gave time for the home field magic to kind of kick in and then wear off. And not only did Washington face plant in week one, it wasn't a setup for a home field upset. It was a setup for Michigan's home field magic to maintain dominance. Home field magic is a very complicated thing. We're still not sure how it works, but we're thinking Ohio State collection month before the game, worth a shot. So once again, use promo code BucketProblem for 15% off your first order from homefield.com, homefieldapparel.com. Good Lord, I've done this promo enough that I should be able to read that well. But yes, let's think about, maybe putting a Buckeye collection out there, and also a Michigan refresh. You know, let's cover all our bases. Now we can talk about how Aiden Hutchinson was absolutely rampant in this freaking game, because he's going up against, I forgot to look at his name before we started, but Washington's left tackle is like an all-conference player and supposedly like a potential first-round NFL draft pick. So unlike a lot of the stuff with Washington's offense where you kind of have to throw it away because they're coached by John Donovan and might not have that much talent out there, what Aiden Hutchinson did seems terrifyingly repeatable.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Dan before the season making a prediction that Aiden Hutchinson could lead the country in sacks, and I was like, okay, Dan, let's take it easy here.
I said he was going to be. I said he would be defensive player of the year in the conference and an All-American. That was okay. My take.
I was on the sacks hot take. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, well, both of those takes are looking a lot better than they did 2 weeks ago because, yeah, I did not know that Washington's left tackle was an NFL prospect, and Hutchinson made that guy look bad. And I think he's currently tied for third in the country in sacks right now. But yeah, his presence, just, you got to send more than one guy to block him because he's going to get pressure on the QB if not.
Well, there was that really cool fourth down play where Washington sent no guys to block him. I enjoyed that thoroughly.
He got a QB hit on the quarterback with an All-American tight end. Like, he drove the tight end back into the quarterback and, like, did... And, like, I think, Ace, you tweeted about this. It was, like, a weird little Madden. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, he's so strong that, like, the quarterback sort of flew back at a speed that didn't feel like it should have been possible. It was, like, a very awkward-looking play that you would see, like, in Madden. And it was... He definitely made it happen. And, yeah, he's... It's crazy to see what he is able to do just as a pure edge rusher, because he's just always been, you know, last year especially was an anchor primarily, right? And like had so many run responsibilities that he had to worry about first. And this year as just a pure edge rusher, like he's such a terror, and it's really great to see.
Yeah, and he does hold up well against the run, but yeah, I think especially in personnel when there's three defensive tackles out there, he really can get after the QB.
Yeah, I think like we've seen this, and we just talked about Ohio State, but their recent history is a great example. The simplest cheat code in college football and defenses is to have that just destructive edge rusher that you have to double team or otherwise scheme dramatically against as an offense. Like, that has been the key to Ohio State's success. Their monster 2019 team, which might have been their most loaded team ever, with Chase Young. And I think also this is where, because as good as Aiden Hutchinson is, he is that level of problem by himself. I also want to give Mike McDonald some credit for, again, mm-hmm. unleashing him in scheme. Like, McDonald has unearthed some actual depth in the defensive line, which, like, was one of our biggest concerns coming into this year. Like, he's got Mike Morris as kind of an anchor in even front sometimes, or just sort of like a hybrid edge DL. I don't know what you'd call him, but he's playing a serious role. Chris Jenkins is kind of starting to emerge. I think Whitley even got into this game last game.
Yes, so, wearing a single digit number and like not being moved at all. Yeah. I love it.
He looked hysterical out there. Number three.
Anyone weighing over 330 pounds should be wearing a single digit number.
Absolutely.
It's and cute. I think, like, you know, I mean, McDonald, this is where I want to take a moment to just say, like, look, I don't know what the ceiling for this Michigan defense is, and I do expect them to get exposed at some point, or multiple points, just because I don't think they're an elite unit yet. But I will say, like, this thus far into the year, when I see, like, Jalen Harrell kind of bench second-year edge guy, like, you know, taking Cade Otton out of the game in coverage, I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. At the very least, these coaches are getting the most out of these guys, and that is really nice to see.
Yeah, I think I had actually a couple of general defensive takes. First of all, I think it's interesting, you know, you mentioned the interior defensive line play, and I think it's been a genuine positive. Washington's O-line seems like it's just going to be a huge bust this year. So those caveats apply. I will say, like, coming into the year, both Western Michigan and Washington were supposed to have good veteran offensive lines. So, I mean, you know, I'm going to hold off on, like, going on buying in fully quite yet. But, like, it's hard not to be a little bit encouraged, at least. Definitely stock way up. But I think it's interesting something that they're doing. They're actually lifting Mozzie Smith, which they definitely need to do because he's too big to play every snap. They're using him strategically when they go into their nickel package where they only have two defensive tackles on the field. And because they need him when they only have two. But when they have three defensive tackles, they're actually using some of their smaller, quote-unquote smaller, we're talking like 315 pounds, they're using some of their smaller interior linemen because when they have three defensive tackles, everyone gets single blocking, which is actually interesting and, like, I thought, you know, might not work on teams that can consistently, like, get doubles on, you know, the nose tackle. But at least for right now, like, using being able to use Donovan Jeter or, like, Mike Morris as the nose with, like, two other defensive tackles seems like it's a good way to, like, wring some more snaps out of our, like, pretty thin defensive line. But then more on the negative side, I will say, like, especially later in the game, there are still some breakdowns in this zone. There are some players that there's definitely some, like, you know, pre-snap, like, pointing and, like, trying to figure out. There's a couple plays where we didn't get lined up. And there's definitely a couple plays where, like, two zone defenders are, like, right next to each other. And when you see that, that usually means something has gone wrong. So, like, definitely still figuring things out. But that part's only going to get better. And, you know, Western Michigan and Washington both probably don't have very good offenses. But this is what, like, a good defense does to bad offenses, you know, is, like, limit them to, like, under 14 points. So, you know, I think it's hard not to be stock up overall on the defense.
Yeah, and McDonald was also doing a pretty interesting job of rotating players, not just up and up front, but on the back end. I mean, we saw Rod Moore, unfortunately, get victimized for Washington's only touchdown, but he also had a pretty nice pass defense out there. I mean, and I would assume that he might have been part of the communication mix-ups because that's a freshman safety. But the fact that they trust these guys enough to rotate them through, I mean, you're going to have the occasional bust when you're installing a new defense, and the fact that it's happening for Michigan late in very comfortable victories when they're playing players that are, you know, on the two deep, but, you know, maybe more like the three deep with Michigan right now. That feels like a pretty encouraging sign. I do want to get to touching. I mean, I think we have to talk about the offensive play calling in more detail, even though I've made my take known on it, which is that, like, if you can run the ball that well, then why bother passing? And while it's frustrating for us as fans to not be able to get a better read on, like, what is Michigan going to try to do this year and how good is Cade McNamara really once he goes against a very legitimate defense. But when you can get through an entire game basically while, like, putting a couple run plays on film, throwing a couple BS screens that get blown up but it doesn't really matter, and having, like, one nice back shoulder fade stick in people's minds, and otherwise just shelve your passing game, like, you do it.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually missed the complaining on Twitter regarding the play calling, but I did have an old-fashioned heckler a couple rows behind me that was complaining about the play calling. Yeah, you know, I mean, if you can run the ball like that, you kind of have to. And Washington was conceding that. Like, there's been a little bit of talk on Twitter from people who have, like, watched film and everything, but it's like Washington kept their safeties back, didn't really load up the box. They clearly were screaming off the edge by the end of the game, but... Yeah, I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right?
Yeah, 6 yards a carry is hard to argue with.
Yeah, and I just want to add this, which is like, this was not an encouraging data point for the passing game. Like, Cade McNamara did have some bad throws. He had some times when he was late, seemingly getting through his reads. We don't know what the receiving situation looks like post Ronnie Bell, although we did miss him as a blocker, which could be a real problem. So like, there's a lot of, I think the key things are a lot of question marks. And as Michigan fans, and we see question marks on offense or anywhere at this point, we start freaking out. And I understand that. I do it. We were all doing it in the group chat. I think in the cold light of day, though, like, you know, most of what I've seen from Cade McNamara over the last two seasons, I've liked. I think he's shown a lot of consistency prior to this game. And this was probably his worst game as a passer. And I am pretty confident that Michigan has some interesting things in their playbook that they're just loath to use. And I do think Jim Harbaugh has more of an NFL attitude about this, where he does not really believe in the whole like game reps philosophy for your offense. He likes to keep things under wraps. And that we could say that might be a problem as far as like player confidence and just getting stuff fully installed. Like, I'm not saying that that's inherently good, but I do think that like, given the complexity of the run game in this game, for instance, I don't think the problem is like the playbook is too shallow or whatever. I think that Michigan just doesn't want to tip their hand until they have to. And I think, for instance, you'll see things like they'll go to that, you know, Stanford ogre alignment that they were using on the goal line at some point and then run some trickery off it, and Penn State or someone will hopefully be caught flat footed. I think that stuff's coming. So,
you know, it's really funny that Michigan fans would potentially complain about a 10-play drive of all runs that ends with just pushing Washington into the end zone, because isn't that what we want? Isn't that like the Platonic ideal of successful Big Ten football, is just pushing a team right down the field into the end zone over and over?
I mean, in fairness, this certainly was the case for my end. I think the complaints were more coming from, say, Michigan handing it off on 3rd and 10 in their own territory in the first half, or calling like a really just totally biffed zone read on another 3rd and long. Situations where it felt like it was still sort of a game, even though I felt very comfortable with the outcome pretty much as soon as Michigan scored. But in those situations, you wanted to see Michigan throw the ball as a fan. It was frustrating when the runs didn't work. And then when you go and look back at how the game played out, you're like, okay, like maybe that was actually fine and I overreacted a bit.
Yeah, that's all fair. I do think it's impossible not to be at least a little bit concerned about the future of the passing game based on what we saw in week 2. But,
yeah,
you know, hopefully over the course of September, you know, a couple more home games, Cade and the passing offense can get a little warmed up heading into Wisconsin.
So I want to kind of break this down into like two buckets, because I was complaining. I'm one of them. It's you. It's me. You're talking about, Alex, that was complaining. I'm not complaining as much as some others, but was complaining a little bit on Twitter. I kind of want to break it down into two buckets. It's A, like you have the runs on like 3rd and long, which I was generally like kind of annoyed about, because not kind of, I was very annoyed about, especially when the game is still close. Because it's just just generally a bad call, especially one of them was like a fake zone read to speed option, which was just totally doomed.
Oh, that was brutal.
Yeah, but that was a bad one. We've tried to run that a couple times and it doesn't work whatever. We don't have to get into it, but it doesn't work if you don't
you gotta
run
the
zone
read
first. Exactly. Exactly. It doesn't work. So there was that part, which I found annoying, and I just think like generally, yes, you should pass on 3rd and long. And like, I know that, you know, they kind of had made the calculation at that point that like, hey, we don't think Washington can beat us unless we turn it over. But I still just think like, yeah, but what is the real risk of like turning it over on like one passing play on 3rd and long? Whatever. Okay, fine. I'll write that off as like, you know, as being pretty, maybe overly conservative. The other point that I complained about during the game but have kind of come back down on is the fact that there was no real play action off of their, they ran one play action play, basically. And it was, by the way, was wide open. And if Hassan Haskins makes a block, it's going to be a chunk play. But I digress. What I've kind of come to realize now is that I think that basically, like, Washington never loaded the box in the way that that Western Michigan did, or the way that some other teams might be when or might do when they're getting run all over. Washington rolled safeties down, but they rolled safeties down to the perimeter to protect again. Anytime that a tight end would come in short motion and, you know, like threaten to kind of like go to the other flat, we would run any kind of like flare motion, they would rotate a safety down and basically like be really aggressive about like, hey, you're not going to get easy yards in the perimeter from us. But they never actually rolled a safety down into the box. They were playing either even or a man down in the box pretty much at all times. And Michigan made the decision that, like, okay, if you're not going to dedicate more material to the box and you're not going to actually stop any of our runs, we're going to run it on every standard down. And it worked. And the offense was incredibly efficient. And I can't argue about that. I think my general concern about the offense is that through pretty much since 2018, we have not had a play action game that actually looks like our running game. Like even that year in 2018 where they were running the ball so well, they did not really take advantage of it in the play action game. And I do worry a little bit that that's like a Harbaugh problem. And I'm going to hold out hope that it's in the playbook and that we have stuff that's going to like pop guys wide open like a good running game should do. But I just like, I want to be able to see that. And I'm probably not going to see it for the next two games. Hopefully I'll see it against Wisconsin. Anyway, sorry, long-winded rant.
I think that's a good transition to the final point I want to really hammer home here, which is that on the surface, this game looked like vintage Harbaugh, and from some angles, not in a good way, right? Because we say vintage Harbaugh, we think about a kind of stubborn, bang-your-head-against-a-wall running game that can look uncreative, especially if you don't know all the nuances, which I certainly don't. I mean, there's a lot of details to these blocking schemes, but here's the big difference, right? Yes, this is the stuff Harbaugh loves to do, but it's in the context of a game plan that, you know, looking at the result, was clearly correct and indisputably worked. And then the actual play calling, as Dan just elaborated, the actual play calling responded to what Washington did in response to the game plan, right? The actual play calling was strategic and flexible rather than dogmatic and stubborn. So it's not vintage Harbaugh in the sense that this is just a stubborn refusal to do anything but the few things we want to do. It's actually, this is what you want from your offensive coordinator, from your game plan, no matter the situation, which is to have a good game plan coming in and then to run the things that are actually working as the defense adjusts. And so I think it's tough to complain about from that point of view, even though it's totally valid to be worried about what's coming in the future.
Yeah, another big reason to not complain about the lack of passes and specifically the lack of play action is as... again, Seth Fisher detailed in a post on MGo blog today, Michigan ran RPOs, like a whole bunch of them. A lot of those counters had players going out into pass routes. And that's a really good way to have a play action game work off of your run game, is to just have them both mashed together into one play. The problem, at least as far as like seeing passes go into the air is concerned, is that Washington never made Michigan go to the pass read, because they were screaming. They were playing to let Michigan give. And they played to prevent Michigan from going to the air. And they took it in the face as a result. And it also meant that we didn't get to see Michigan throw the ball much, because that it would have been silly to do so, given the situation. So, yeah, I mean, there's some worries about the fact that McNamara wasn't smoothly and quickly going through his reads on a couple plays. But we're talking about two or three pass attempts at this point where that happened. And it's hard for me to get too worked up when the sample size is that small. A couple other things I wanted to get to really quick before we hit our picks for this week. One thing that I really love seeing on offense that we haven't mentioned yet was Blake Corum lining up in the slot with Michigan going empty in the backfield and converting a third down. Also, Michigan going tempo in the run game back-to-back after a decent second down run, set up a third and one. They tempoed to the line, caught Washington completely off guard, also like the entire ESPN production and every Michigan fan in the world. But that was easy and a really encouraging thing to see in the offense. And then I think we've touched on it before, but the decision to fake that punt absolutely, you know, it basically ended the game. And really, it was great to see Harbaugh have aggression in that particular scenario.
Yeah, I do want to say about the fake punt, like, I know we kind of lament like the fact that we still sort of use an outdated punting formation, which, you know, it's halfway true because they do have more gunners out there now. But I do think like just the ability to run that dive play on a fourth and one out of that punt formation is so tough to stop if you send your punt team out. And I think that alone is like worth not having maybe as good of coverage. So I want to put myself firmly in the I like the old punt formation camp because it is a lot more conducive to fakes. You basically cannot run a fake out of a modern, you know, spread punt formation.
And Michigan in this game averages, I thought Brad Robbins did a great job. He averages 46 yards per punt with an average return of a single yard. And pins one inside the 20, hits two for 50 or more yards, forces two fair catches. That's, I mean, the downside to what Michigan does is hypothetically giving up returns, and he's hanging them up there, and Michigan is getting guys down the field to the point where they're not giving them up. So at that point, if you can also threaten blocks and on one side and prevent them with your formation, and then also be able to run more threatening fakes, that's become a real advantage. So I think we have to embrace the at least somewhat pro style punt formation. That brings us to the pick section, and I am kind of loath to introduce it because I finished last week, and I am now last on the season. I went 1-3. I am now 2-6-1 over the last 2 weeks. I'm getting washed a little bit, at least in the picks that I'm throwing out there in public. Alex went 3-1 to take our picks column last week. Connor and Dan both went 2-2. Dan is currently our overall leader at 5-3-1 on his picks. So fade me and play Dan, I guess. This is a terrifying thing. Yeah, that's where we are right now. I have written fuck my life in the show notes. All right, these are lines taken from PointsBet as of Tuesday around, I don't know, 4:30 p.m. So they may have changed by the time you pick this up, you're listening to this, especially if you hang around and listen to our Sickos game of the week, because that line has moved quite a bit. But we start off with, I think this is a Friday game, and it is a Big Ten game. Maryland travels to at Illinois. Maryland travels to Illinois. They are favored by 7.5 points, the Terrapins. The over-under for this one is 60.5. All of us picked Maryland. I'm not even going to throw it to each individual person here because this is Maryland versus Illinois. We all picked Maryland. I assume we all think that Maryland's passing game is so much more explosive than anything Illinois can do on offense that there's just nothing Illinois can do to keep this particularly close without a fluke.
Yeah, baffled by this line. It almost makes me suspicious, but I'm not going to overthink it. I think Illinois is horrendous, and I think Maryland is like has a legitimately good offense. So that's all I'll say about this one.
Yeah, I don't know who's setting this line, but like I'm actually a Maryland skeptic. Like I am not a believer, but I do think that like, well, I don't think, I know that their skill guys are just going to be torching Illinois' completely embarrassing defense all night. So,
yeah, I don't have anything to say about this game really, but I do want to mention that my under on the Ohio State Oregon game hit by half a point last week, so that was awesome.
That was what knocked you to 3-1, and I initially had you written down as 2-2 because I'm not good at mental math.
That's my cue to say I knew that Oregon was going to at least beat the spread, and all of you doubted me. And who's laughing now?
I'm laughing all the way to the bank right now, brother.
Connor, right. if only you had believed in Michigan. Wait, you did.
I did, yeah.
But what did you miss on? Oh, Iowa State.
I believe in Iowa State.
I picked Iowa money line. I picked Iowa money line.
Yeah, Alex got his advantage from picking Iowa. We were all wrong about Nebraska, and I have in all caps lock of the week next to Buffalo. Go me. I'm really killing it. Let's move past that one Big Ten matchup from this week. The next one on the docket is the one we're obligated to do. Northern Illinois. Plus 27 at the moment at Michigan. I think this opened with Michigan favored more like 23. This has moved significantly in Michigan's direction. The total is 54.5. I am so much in the stay away camp on this 27 point line that I'm not making a pick for it so I don't lose it. I am saying to play the over on this one because I think Michigan is going to be able to run all over Northern Illinois, but not necessarily in a way where it's moving slowly. And, I mean, we've seen Rocky Lombardi pick apart a Michigan secondary before. I don't know. Like, I think Northern Illinois is good for at least, like, 10 points, and that might be all that's needed to hit this over. But in general, I would say to stay the hell away from this one. I think that's the general take, but Connor has more notes than anybody else on this one, so I'm going to throw it to him.
Okay, so you should actually never with real money bet a 27-point spread. But
Not true. I have hit some of those early on because they set them too low in some cases.
That's true. But
Massachusetts and Connecticut may be involved.
I will say, though, I have a governing philosophy here for these picks, and I'm going to stick my neck out, which is I have been bullish on Michigan in these picks, and that has led to two dominant performances by the Michigan football team. So even though 27 points is far too many, I'm going to pick Michigan in the hopes that that helps them play their best on Saturday. I'm going to do it for you boys, doing it for the team.
Yeah, I'm fantastic. Not betting this game.
Thank you, Alex, for
I'm going to avoid the jinx and I'll just say NIU, bit of a hangover game, noon game. 27 points is a lot. Northern Illinois probably has a good enough offense to like put up some points on our backups and kind of get a backdoor cover. So Northern Illinois, but Michigan wins by like 24. So
yeah, and if you say anything about Rocky Lombardi, I am coming down there. So
Will also, speaking of backdoor covers, I will make one note here because I have some intel on Northern Illinois. They played Wyoming last week, which is a team that I know well. Craig Bohl is possibly the man balliest coach in FBS, and Wyoming scored 50 on Northern Illinois.
Yeah, that was a whooping.
Yeah, the last time that Craig Bohl scored 50 on a team was probably when he was at North Dakota State in the old FCS days. So that should tell you the state of Northern Illinois' defense, and I think even if Michigan goes backups for the entire second half, they're going to hang some points on these guys. I promise you that.
Over. Hit that over. The next game, oh my God, I can't believe this game is still on the schedule. I guess this has looked marginally better the last week or two, but week zero just laid a really horrifying foundation for this one. Nebraska getting 22 points at Oklahoma. The total for this one is 61.5. I am picking the Sooners, even though we just talked about how big lines are terrifying. And Adrian Martinez has at least played significantly better over the last couple weeks than he looked in week one. But this line is already at 22.5, depending on which sports book you're using. So if you can get Oklahoma at 22 points, I would say do it. I don't think there's much more to explain other than Oklahoma has Spencer Rattler and an incredibly explosive offense, and Nebraska is Nebraska.
I would like to interject real quickly here. So this rivalry, extinct rivalry, is weirdly near and dear to my heart because both of my maternal grandparents. One of them went to Oklahoma, one of them went to Nebraska, and for, you know, a couple of decades there, it was one of the best rivalries in all of college football. Oklahoma has managed to keep up that standard into the present day. Nebraska, unfortunately, has not. But I have been excited to see this game on the schedule for several years because it was so special to my family. My mom grew up a huge college football fan and wound up going to Michigan. And yeah, I don't know. Both of my grandparents have passed, and I think they both would be really disappointed that I'm betting this game, but I'm going to take the over.
That's lovely. All right. Connor and Dan both have Oklahoma. We're going to try to get through these quick because there are more games on the schedule than usual, at least that are worth discussing, I guess. Cincinnati, -3.5 at Indiana with an over-under of 50. This almost feels like a trap.
Who is setting these lines?
Kind of like the Maryland game does. Because Cincinnati's a very good football team. I mean, they may not be quite as good as they were last year, but I also don't know that for sure. And Indiana just looks like a whole mess right now. And I mean, I'll put it this way. I have seen and heard comparisons from Indiana fans drawing a parallel between Nick Sheridan and one of his mentors, Mike DeBoard. And if that does not strike fear in your heart when thinking about putting real money on Indiana football, it should. And that's why the over-under in this game is only 50 points. So I'm taking Cincy. This is my lock of the week, which scares me, as does the fact that, spoiler alert, we all picked Cincy. And I would stay away from that total because it's kind of frighteningly low. But man, this is one that definitely feels trappy.
I think that, yeah, I just don't believe in Indiana's offense. Yeah, I mean, Cincinnati just, it feels like Indiana's coming back down to our earth, pretty damn hard here. I think they'll figure it out at a certain point during the season, but I don't think that's against Cincinnati this week. So, I'm going with Cincy.
All right, we are moving right ahead to a game between, this is a weird one, Michigan State +6.5 at Miami, which is just coming off of realizing what it's like to play Alabama early in the season. Don't ever do it. Just don't. Total on this one is 56.5. I am taking Miami. I think they get very warm, soothing feeling of lining up and realizing you're not across from Alabama players. And but also playing Alabama makes it very difficult to figure out if a team is good or not. So I don't feel great about this pick, but at the same time, I don't feel great about Michigan State covering, even though they did look pretty competent on offense last week against Youngstown State in a way where, like, it looked somewhat repeatable, even though the opponent was obviously at a pretty low level. Alex, I think you've got the flip side of this one.
Yeah, I was actually tempted to pull the trigger on the State money line because there is some chance that they could be pretty decent. Whereas with Miami playing Alabama the first week of the season, you just get destroyed, you get beat up. And I think, you know, they showed some statistic during week one of like all of the teams that had played season openers against Alabama. And it really messes you up for the rest of the season in most cases. So Michigan State gets almost a touchdown. I felt comfortable taking them against the spread, but yeah, I think Sparty could pull a surprise this weekend.
I think that it's actually like, this is going to be an interesting game. I think Michigan State has looked definitely well coached and competent, but we know almost nothing about them because Northwestern is horrendous. I'm going to beat that drum for the entire season. They are awful, like awful, awful, awful. And Youngstown State is Youngstown State. And I think Michigan State's defense has actually looked a little bit shaky. But I think they're better coached than Miami, but Miami is a lot faster. And they're also, Miami's definitely battle tested. I mean, they got kind of, I mean, they got smoked by Alabama, which gives you like a, you know, a good idea of like, you know, how, I mean, you've definitely like, you've lost, like you've been punched in the mouth already this season, whereas Michigan State definitely hasn't. And then they also beat what is, I know, you know, you're all going to laugh, but like pretty decent Appalachian State team last week.
None of us are laughing at that. Yeah, no, none of us are laughing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think it's going to be an interesting game. I really don't quite know what to expect, but it's at Miami. It's going to be hot. It's going to be humid, and Miami has by far the better quarterback and a lot more talent. And I think they could potentially score a lot of points to this Michigan State defense, which I think is low-key very, very shaky. So I'm going to go with Miami, even though I think I've been pretty fair to Michigan State on this podcast. I was the only one that told you to bet them week one. So
you've been way too fair to them, actually.
Yes. Yeah, if anything, you have flipped too far in the other direction. But I'm with you on the Miami pick, albeit somewhat tentatively. But De'Aaron King does seem like a good reason to put money on them. Some interlocutor has put Purdue at Notre Dame on our show notes. Purdue is +7.5, apparently. I do not know the total because I tried to leave this game off. Dan, I believe you might be at fault here. I don't know.
My girlfriend said we have to talk about this game.
She has to sit through you recording this, yeah. So fair enough.
She has to be quiet. She has to be quiet while we record this podcast. And I have to turn the AC off every time. It's a whole thing. So she said, "I swear to God, if you don't talk about Purdue and Notre Dame, I'm gonna lose it." Purdue's obviously covering and winning. Purdue money line lock. You know, bet the mortgage.
The money line you didn't even write down.
She literally texted me. She's like, "Are you about to talk about Purdue?" And I'm like, "Oh shit, got to put it on the show."
I'm gonna give a serious analysis here, which is that I've seen enough Brian Kelly. So my dad's a Notre Dame alumnus, so I've been exposed to them a lot, and I have seen enough Brian. He's also a Michigan alumnus. Shut up, Dan. You're a Michigan State fan now. Shut up. anyway, I've seen enough Brian Kelly teams to know what they do, which is like they love to like have some horrible game early in the season where they barely eke out a win, and then like turn around and cave somebody's head in. And their seasons are always deeply like very postmodern, like incoherent, no clear narrative arc. All of which is to say, I think Notre Dame's going to beat the crap out of Purdue this weekend.
Yeah, I don't really have much of a take on this game besides Jeff Brohm probably isn't a great coach. Another game that was not originally on the show notes that I did bet is Penn State -6 against Auburn at home. Just wanted to throw that in there.
Oh, that one I actually should have put on here and just forgot. So that's my bad on that.
Yeah, Auburn hasn't really played anyone, and it's a road game. It's their first road game of the year, their first decent opponent. Penn State is battle-tested with a decent road victory. So yeah, I went with the Lions there.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and make the call since I run the show that games that were not on the show notes do not count for the picks tally. At least for people who did not see them before we started making the pick. Connor and Dan, you are going to get hell tears, especially if Notre Dame covers, Dan. Yeah, I don't know who I'd take in that one. I apologize for getting Purdue or Penn State Auburn on this list. That one actually is an interesting game. Instead, I got completely thrown and distracted by seeing this game on the schedule, which I'm going to ask Connor to explain. Northwestern is a 3-point favorite at Duke. This is a football game that these two institutions decided would be okay to play and even put in a 4 o'clock time slot so that a whole bunch of people would think, you know what, this might be funny. Let's watch it. The total is 49.5, which is disgusting. This opened with Northwestern favored by 9.5, and apparently enough people have watched Northwestern try to play offense that it immediately moved like 6.5 points. It's probably still moving as I speak. I am staying as far the fuck away from this game as possible. If I did have to bet, it'd probably be Duke's money line, but this is gross. Connor, what the fuck?
Hey, 9.5 points? Seriously?
Nine and a half. I don't even know if they can score 9 points.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, Northwestern, okay. Like, here's the thing. This is set. The reason that Northwestern's favored is because Duke opened the season by losing to Charlotte, which is one of those programs that, like, are they FCS or FBS? No one knows. I'm not going to check.
Nope.
But Duke likes to do this too. Duke loves to open the season looking wretched and then get things together to the point where they're respectable. That's been a big pattern under Cutcliffe. And I am with Dan. I think Northwestern is absolutely terrible at football this year. I think that their defense is probably even worse than a lot of their fans may think. And we know that their offense is, I mean, frankly, FCS level, despite having a 5-star quarterback, which is very funny. But I think Duke can cover that at home. I mean, I don't know why Northwestern would get 3 points in any game against someone not in the FCS this year. That's ridiculous.
On the road, what? And what?
They're all going to get together at midfield and, like, read the Iliad and the Odyssey.
That's our lock of the week.
This is the
Someone's bringing a book.
I'm picking Duke as well.
Yeah, I was about to say that both of these teams are probably way better at investment banking and management consulting than they are at football, so maybe they should just fast forward to that.
Unlike Michigan, which is just as good at investment banking.
Oh, God. I'm so upset that this is being played. I'm so upset at that opening line and that someone thought that was a good idea, and also that I didn't jump on it when it existed. Because goodness gracious, if Northwestern covers 9.5 points, I will keel over. But Duke at +120 sounds pretty interesting. If it still exists by the time you listen to this, they might be favored by 6 at this point. Who knows? I don't know when you're listening. But that's it for the show this week. Thank you to everybody who's tuned in. I will have more details on the whole going premium bit with the newsletter and the second podcast feed later in the week. We are working on a little special promotion for the launch, so we don't want to do that prematurely. So go to thebucketproblem.com, and you can stay updated on all of this. Subscribe to the newsletter and the podcast. Rate us, review us, set us to download on your podcast app. That is super important for, like, us making money, which would be really, really nice. Use promo code BucketProblem at homefieldapparel.com. Contact thebucketproblem@gmail.com for inquiries. And thank you very much for listening. Have a great week.